Hello, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
Big changes afoot. It's a day of metamorphosis, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. No, are you talking about the new top I'm wearing?
I'm talking about well, we have new friends in the studio. And I always like to give new friends in the studio a shout out. Everybody, give it up for Rug.
Yeah, Rug.
That's right. We have Rug in the studio today. How's it going, Rug? Oh, Rug, you're crazy. It's a circular rug with a sick geometric pattern. I think it really ties the whole room together. Let's also give it up for six new floating shelves.
Six new floating shelves. Mm-hmm.
Haven't really taken a lot of time to put things on those floating shelves. They're more aspirational.
Griffin has had to do a fair amount of video work recently.
Yes.
And it has brought to light that his office needed a little oomph.
Yeah, I think during a D&D streaming thing, or like some sort of RPG streaming thing that we did during the last Max Fun Drive, Austin Walker from Friends at the Table said that my office looked like a hotel business center. And it really cut me deep. Really, it's looking huge in here. And that's the thing that everybody was thinking about when I was talking about the metamorphosis today, mm-hmm. was that there's nothing else happening in the country that's bigger than Rug.
I know everybody's tuned in to CNN right now for the live stream of Rug.
It's a live Rug stream. Don't miss it. Who's going to step out onto the rug? No, probably just me and Rachel.
Just Griffin.
Hey, do you have any small wonders?
Can you go first?
I mean, it's inauguration day. We are recording this in the morning time. I think things are already maybe happening a little bit. And that's very exciting, turning over a new page. Stoked about that. But I don't know. Can you go first?
I'm going to say a fashionable glove.
Mm.
Part of what I have enjoyed at the inauguration is the winter wear.
Yeah.
Most specifically the type of glove that the folks are putting on their hands. Because a lot of people don't think about that.
No.
And there's a great clip of Bernie Sanders coming in wearing these mittens.
Oh, I got to see that.
They're just darling.
So he's not feeling the burn. Or I guess he is feeling, he's not feeling the chill, the icy chill. That's really nothing. I'm going to say, God, I don't know, man. I've been playing, I know I talk about chess a lot on this show, and I've been playing a lot. But there's a thing that I really like doing called pinning, where you aim a piece at the king, but there's a piece in between them that your opponent has, and then so they can't move it. And so it's like, oh, I bet you'd like to use that rook, but you can't move it.
Oh.
I own that rook is mine now, and I'm going to stomp on it however I want. So satisfying every time. sorry that it wasn't more interesting than that. Do you want to tell me about your first thing, though?
Yes. My first thing is blinking.
You're really... We were talking yesterday about how you were struggling to come up with a concept, like topics for this week. Uh-huh. And you're like, it could get to the point where I would just talk about something really, really sort of basic, like blinking. I feel like you said.
I don't think I said blinking.
Okay. Well, here we are. Let's moisten those eyes together.
There is nothing basic about blinking.
You're telling me every time you blink, you go like, that's the stuff.
It's so critical, and it makes a huge difference. I read a lot about blinking.
All right.
And a lot of the kind of the eye strain issues and the problems that we all have with technology are due to not blinking enough.
Yeah, I'm always saying that. Not drinking enough water, not getting enough sleep. Mm-hmm. Sleep is like one big blink if you think about it. It's like a blink, but with dreams in it.
Uh-huh. Hmm? Not your most poetic assertion, but I'll go with it.
I think it's actually maybe my most poetic assertion.
The average person blinks 15 to 20 times per minute, or about 1,200 times per hour.
I bet I could do more.
Yeah, probably.
Is that a fucking challenge? Ow. Why does it hurt when you do it this fast?
Later in this segment, I will introduce a blinking exercise.
Oh, fine. Okay.
So you can take on that challenge.
Okay. Are you any good at staring contests where you don't blink? I'm dog shit at them. I cannot do it. I have tender baby eyes that need to be just so intricately maintained.
I mean, they're national treasures.
They are, yeah.
Not a lot of people realize how beautiful Griffin's eyes are.
No, they're two deep pools.
I think it's because you hide them behind glasses, which you think would emphasize them.
No. Nope.
But in fact, people can't really. They're so magical.
Yeah, Rachel's the only one that gets to see me without glasses.
And the glass really obstructs them.
That's true. Mm-hmm. But enough about me.
Some animals, such as turtles and hamsters, blink their eyes independently of each other.
It's a cool look. I bet every hamster's like, are you trying to get with me? Oh, no. You're moistening your eyes one at a time. My mistake. I got very excited.
There are a lot of muscles up in there. I don't think I realized how many muscles. I'm not going to say the names of the muscles because I don't think anybody really needs to know them, but...
There's your occipital flange. You have an occipital flange on each one, right? That's one of them. The occipital flange.
Okay, so there is a muscle that opens the eye. There's a muscle that is in the upper eyelid, and there is a muscle that functions as a squinting and winking muscle.
Why not just have one muscle do all that stuff?
There's a muscle that pulls the lower lid down when you're looking down, when you're widening out your eyes. There's a muscle in there.
I don't like this.
I know, a lot of muscles in there. Blinking is also a way to kind of determine whether or not there are particular illnesses or disorders of the nervous system. Because the blinking can be a criteria for medical conditions.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Infants do not blink at the same rate of adults. So you know how I mentioned 15 to 20 times per minute for an adult?
Yeah.
Infants only blink an average of 1 to 2 times in a minute.
Can babies do anything right? We're about to have another one, and like I feel like I know a lot about the shortcomings of babies now. So I'm just going to be looking at this kid's eyes like, blink, what are you doing?
The article, now I didn't read a lot of studies on this, obviously, but the article I read, they're kind of uncertain as to why that's the case.
Huh.
There's a suggestion that there's just kind of less surface area, and so there's less lubrication needed.
Right.
Also, infants get more sleep, and so there's less fatigue.
Okay.
Maybe that's why.
Yeah. Lazy, too, aren't they?
So when eyes dry out or become fatigued, that's often because you are not blinking as much. So if you are reading or focusing on an object for an extended period, your rate of blinking decreases to about 3 to 4 times per minute.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's why, like, I feel like now, especially if I try and read at the end of the day,
yeah,
it's much harder than it used to be because I'm like looking at a screen all day and then I go to try and read and my eyes dry out real fast.
Well, for me, I noticed this last night. I was reading a book on my Kindle after you'd gone to bed, right? And so it's like illuminated backlight. And depending on like the angle that I'm laying down while I'm reading, sometimes my left eye, which has that blind spot, will just drift, like wildly drift to the side. And I have to like blink to like... recenter. Yeah,
that is the big suggestion, is that if you make a conscious effort to blink every 10 to 15 seconds, it'll keep your vision sharper while
who makes working. A conscious effort to blink every 10 to 15 seconds? How long could you maintain that? It would be the only thing you did all day.
You need to put a little alarm on your phone
that goes off every 10 to 15 seconds.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's gonna make you very popular in the Zoom meetings.
Okay, so here is a blinking exercise.
Sure.
Set aside 5 1-minute sessions spread throughout the day, every day for 2 weeks to blink. During each minute, look each of the 5 forward directions, up, down, left, right, center, and blink 10 times in each direction. You should make sure your eyes are closing fully, but do not squeeze your lids tight.
How do I look right now? Cool?
Real cool.
Do I look really cool right now? This is hard, babe. How do you blink looking up? Ow. Ow. Fuck. Ow. God. God, why does this hurt my eyes to do that? Hey, folks at home, I feel like we should put a disclaimer in. Don't do this because you may hurt your eyeballs.
I was wondering a lot because I can only wink one eye.
And that's true.
It made me wonder about the muscles on the right side of my face that I can't, like,
yeah,
you know, I can't wink.
Watching you try to wink with that side of your face is among my favorite things in the world. Sometimes you just, like, don't close either eye, so you do what you just did, which is kind of, like, move your head diagonally a little bit.
Like, you know.
And sometimes I have to, like, that's the sign I have to know in order to know that it's on, you know?
I can wink my left eye.
Yeah, that's
true. At least I think I can. Now I'm embarrassed to try.
Let's see it. Can I say something? You make a meal of it. Every single part of your face, even your right eye is, like, contributing somehow. Can I tell you about my first thing?
Yes.
My first thing is trading card games or collectible card games, which Whoa. Is like this. It's something that I have had so much exposure to, and it's something that I would be willing to bet you have had virtually zero exposure to. You never have played a Magic the Gathering or anything along those lines, I'm assuming.
You know what? I feel like a real cool kid on this podcast sometimes.
Hey, there's nothing not cool about not playing Magic the Gathering. That sentence got away from me a little bit, but it's been a minute since I've been in the scene. Yeah. I think especially now in these pandemic times, like virtual, you know, online trading card games, whether they are sort of a virtual extension of a Magic the Gathering or Hearthstone is the big one. That's the one I used to play a whole lot.
I noticed you're not saying Pokemon, and I'm wondering
why. Pokemon is coming later. Okay. We will talk about Pokemon. Okay. But like, I played a lot of trading card games growing up to varying degrees of like seriousness. Pokemon's probably the most serious I got in that I competed in Pokemon tournaments with my beautiful deck. It's a psychic fighting type deck, which
And you sold off some of those cards to like get through college, right?
Not to get through college. No, I sold a binder of all of my cards. And these were like first generation original run Pokemon cards that are now worth a disgusting amount of money. I had a Charizard. I had a hologram Charizard from a first series that would be worth so much money. But I sold all of them to build a PC when I was in college.
That is an important thing. No, don't I mean, discount
I
count that.
Yeah, I got like $400 out of it. So like, you know, that was a decent return on investment.
Adjusted for inflation, that's $1 million now.
Adjusted for the value of those cards now, it would be worth much, 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 much more than that. So traditional like collectible card games involve you putting a deck together that you then sort of battle other people's decks with. You can get pre-made sort of starter decks, which is usually how people get their start, which you kind of supplement with booster packs, which, you know, you see videos of people opening a pack that has, you know, 7 or 8 cards in it, and they get excited. Maybe they get a good one. Maybe they get one that has a hologram on it, and that's especially exciting. Very, very shiny cards. I think I collected Pokemon cards long before I ever learned how to actually play the game, because I just liked opening up the deck and seeing pictures of Pokemon, and sometimes they were shiny, and it would be like $5 every time I wanted to get that thrill. Anytime I wanted to... it was essentially... I mean, you're essentially talking about, you know, a fresh pack of smokes at that point. You just need a little bit of a rush. Magic the Gathering is sort of the quintessential trading card game. It was the first one, and it is still very, very much going strong. It was created by a guy named Richard Garfield, who has gone on to make like a few other things, none of which have sort of been the smash hit success that Magic the Gathering has. It came out in 1993 and was just instantly huge, like instantly incredibly, incredibly successful. You could not find Magic cards in the store in 1993. And like the game has gone on to evolve and incorporate all these other things and shed other things. An element in Magic and in a lot of trading card games like back in the day was essentially gambling, where you would have to draw a random card from your deck, and that would be the ante for that game, so that if you lost that game, you would get the opponent's ante. So there was an actual sort of
See, that's what I was wondering about with trading card games. Is it like other games where you end up stealing other people's cards and they're yours now?
I mean, that was sort of that was very quickly sort of phased out. That was an element in Pokemon too, and I definitely got some cool cards that way, and I definitely lost some cool cards that way. And it because there are sort of, as Magic went worldwide, and different countries have like different extremely strict gambling laws, that sort of element has gone by the wayside. But Magic introduced like these concepts, like you have mana cards that you have to spend to cast these spell cards or summon creature cards, and then you battle your opponent's creatures or try to punch through them to actually damage the opponent. And if you lower their health all the way, you win. That is like pretty standardized now. Like that's how Hearthstone works. That's how like all of these other games work. So this game that came out in 1993 really did set the stage for every other trading card game that came after it. And man, did I play a lot of them. I played Magic for a bit. I played Pokemon for a long time, won second place in the Mid-Ohio Con tournament, won a couple of Toys R Us tournaments, which was very exciting.
Can I ask, this is a real practical question, but how do you carry around those cards?
I mean, there's a whole industry.
You're getting ready to play.
Right.
So it's not like you want them in a binder. You want them like ready
to hand. No, so I had a little plastic box, basically, like a little plastic box that was the size of a deck that you take care of. Okay. I was never into, a lot of people put their cards into sleeves. I never did that. Like each card individually, every single one. Yeah. That was never my scene, even when I was like deep in Pokemon. But I mean, I played an X-Men trading card game. I played a Harry Potter trading card game for a while. I think there was a Power Rangers trading card game that I played for a little bit. Huh. And a lot of them were very like derivative of one another. Pokemon was cool because you weren't trying to damage like your opponent. You were just trying to knock out a certain number of enemy Pokemon, and you could like switch them out at will. Pokemon still has a very vibrant and active trading card game scene as well. I think Dragon's Lair, back before pandemic times, had like Pokemon tournaments like all the time.
Do you think you could still do it?
No way.
Not, obviously, you don't have the cards, but like, do you have the skill?
No, I don't think so. There is a certain amount of investment that you have to do. I mean, financial investment, certainly. But I played a lot of Hearthstone when that first came out, and I played it for many years, actually, and there is a huge financial investment that goes into that because you are spending real money on virtual cards to build your deck.
Yeah, I remember seeing you play that.
And so in order to be good, like you not only had to have like a solid deck, you had to essentially know what every card in the game was so you could anticipate what your opponent might have in their deck. It's a huge amount of sort of time investment and money investment that like I do not think I'm capable of anymore.
Yeah.
But I just have always really, really liked it. I twofold, right? I like the idea of you having your deck. My psychic fighting type deck, which was called Brains and Brawn, I like carried that through a couple years, like constantly iterating on it, where I'd like play somebody and I would notice some shortcoming in the deck that I would then try to switch out cards here and there. And so the thing I had was very, this was like before internet, where you would like go on and find out what the best deck is and then just try to replicate that. This was like, this is my sword, there are many like it, but this one is my, like that was like so cool to me as a kid, but also like I was obsessed with opening booster packs and seeing what you got.
I mean, there's still a whole YouTube industry around.
Sure. There was a kiosk at the mall where they would sell you a booster pack and you would open it, and if you got like a hologram Charizard or Blastoise was kind of valuable too, they would buy it right back from you on the spot if you wanted to. Like a Charizard, you could get like $100, like right back, which then you could just reinvest into more booster cards. There's another thing these days called deck building games where you get like a big pack. I think Netrunner is a big one that I've been kind of curious about for a while, but you get just a big box with all the cards in it. And then you sort of draft cards to make a deck when you play it, but you don't have to go out and buy a bunch of, you know, maybe I'll get this very rare card or not. I like card games in general. And I've been kind of itching. There have been like a lot more digital card games coming out lately, and I've been kind of itching to get back into one of those, but I do not think I will ever be able to break back, mostly because I don't know who the fuck I would play those against unless you also wanted to get deep into Magic the Gathering with me these days. No, it would be Pokemon if I got back into one. It probably would be that, but that even seems like a further, which one would you rather play?
I don't know enough about either to really make that call.
That's the correct answer. Can I steal you away?
Yes.
have bumble blimps. Did you know? We have them. And I'd love to read one because this first one was, it's for Tanny and Sean. And it's from Emery Zeitz, who says, "You introduced me to the McElroys and I introduced you to Monster Factory. From there, our friendship has only grown more meaningful. Sean, you are one of the funniest and most thoughtful people. You both are such amazing friends. I'm so thankful and proud to know you two. Here's to more Matwa games and Franksgivings. I love you both." That is, of course, an acronym for Monster of the Week, I believe.
Oh.
The game that we played for Taz Amnesty. I'm just assuming. I can't imagine what else it could stand for. But yeah, I kind of miss that. I kind of miss that system. I kind of wish I was still playing Monster of the Week. Not on in a recorded format, but just for funzos.
Well, I mean, there's still time.
There is still time. I'm a young man.
Can I read the next message?
Please.
This is for Patrick. It is from Melissa. "Hey, Patrick, I'm so proud to call you a best friend. Even though we're far apart, we always have fun and deep conversations about anything and everything. I cherish our terrible puns. Someday we will meet in person and have an excellent best friend hug. I hope you get to chillax every day and throw on a cool record. I love you, bro."
My glasses are filthy right now, and I was kind of like going cross-eyed trying to read the small text on my phone here. And so I did think it said, "I cherish our terrible puma." And I was like, there's a story there. I want to know.
I like there's just enough personal detail here that potentially there is a Patrick and Melissa listening that's like, is this
us?
Me? We,
I do have a terrible puma.
I do. Like chillaxing.
I do say stuff like that a lot.
Welcome back to Fireside Chat on KMAX. With me in studio to take your calls is the dopest duo on the West Coast, Oliver Wong and Morgan Rhodes. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm looking for a music podcast that's insightful and thoughtful, but like also helps me discover artists and albums that I've never heard of.
Yeah, man. Sounds like you need to listen to Heat Rocks every week. Myself, and I'm Morgan Rhodes, and my co-host here, Oliver Wong, talk to influential guests about a canonical album that has changed their lives.
Guests like Moby, Open Mike Eagle, talk about albums by Prince, Joni Mitchell, and so much more.
Yo, what's that show called again?
Heat Rocks, deep dives into hot records.
Every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
What is your second thing?
My second thing. Pockets. All right.
But what is blinking except putting your eyeball in a pocket of flesh?
Sometimes I think of like an everyday thing.
Yes.
And then I'll look into it to see if there's anything there. And a lot of times there's not.
Right.
Pockets, much like blinking, a lot of stuff there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. Definitely. I mean, yeah.
Here's the difference between the two of us.
Uh-huh.
Like, I didn't play a lot of games, you know.
Right.
My time prior to meeting you.
What, a lot of pockets?
A lot of pockets.
You have no excuse, honey. There is no excuse, I feel like. I'm curious to hear about the history of pockets, mm-hmm. right? I'm just saying I have never heard you talk about pockets. I guess maybe in the context of like...
Why do you think I like overalls so much?
Yeah, that's true. It's just pockets all the way down.
Why do you think when I wear a dress, I'm always excited that there's pockets in it?
I feel like you're describing every person who wears dresses.
I know. But here's the thing, all right? So pockets weren't really a thing for women for a very long time.
Sure, yeah.
So that was what was really interesting about this research is that, yeah, like every person I know that wears dresses is like, there are pockets in it. And universally, this is like acclaimed.
Right.
And I was always just like, why is this so exciting? And I realized it's because like, based on the silhouette, based on the history, like whatever's popular at the time, like it is not common to find a functional pocket in an item of clothing for a woman.
Right.
And so this used to be a thing for everybody. In the medieval era, both men and women tied little bags to their waist, which is why when you go to those Renaissance fairs, everybody's got the little bags tied to their waist, you know?
I always just assume there's some sort of unguent in there, some sort of magical dust.
I mean, probably just like weapons, I'm guessing, right?
A little bag tied to your waist that is filled with weapons?
Just little tiny weapons.
Like a tiny, like a small sword?
Little throwing stars?
Like a cocktail sword? Why do you need, why would they need, wait, hold on. You think people at the Ren Faire are walking around with pouches filled with shuriken?
I'm saying the olden days.
You're saying in olden days?
Yeah, people needed little
shuriken to throw around.
Little hidden weapons.
Specifically throwing stars, though.
Well, I don't have a wealth of knowledge on weaponry, so
about that was medieval throwing weapons.
That's what I could think of.
Okay,
just a little tiny mace.
All right,
isn't that cute to think about?
Like a little mace and like a bad guy coming for a knight, and the knight's like, pink, but then he's been killed by the bad guy's regular size weapon.
Part of the reason that we moved to pockets is that for thieves, you really wanted to hide your valuables. You didn't want here's this bag that you can rip off my waist. So pockets became more of a thing too.
I mean, it's the logic there. Like, I want to put my valuables closer to my butt and privates because I'll feel it more. That I will definitely know that you have touched my butt.
Well, you just don't know what somebody has, right. Like with a big bag, you can be like, oh, I bet there's a lot of good stuff in there, but there's a lot of tiny weapons.
Right. Well, that was the whole term cut purse was essentially like that, right? Because you could cut that bag right open and they would never be the wiser about it. You can't cut somebody's butt open. I mean, I guess you can.
I don't really want to get into that.
Yeah, I don't want to either.
In the late 17th century is when you start seeing pockets in clothing permanently sewn into coats and waistcoats and trousers. Women at this time is big, wide skirts. And so you were getting sometimes pockets just in various parts of the skirt, but not in a functional, I can slide my hand in kind of way.
Right.
But in a storage hidden within layers kind of way.
Okay. I guess I don't really understand what the function of that would be if you have to lift your dress up and dig around in there for a bit to pull out your chapstick.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is that it was not a public pocket,
Oh, it was a secret pocket.
It was I've got to go to the powder room and dig in my skirt for 20 minutes to find what I need.
Yeah.
There was also something called the reticule, which was a highly decorated purse.
Whoa.
Also, something called chatelaines, which was waist chains.
Whoa.
These are
wallet chains?
These are the beginning of purses in the 1820s.
But wait, they actually have wallet chains is what you're talking about?
It was a waist chain.
That attached to your valuables?
Yeah.
That's a fucking wallet chain. You can't tell me that's not a fucking medieval wallet chain. I mean, not medieval.
What is a purse? I mean, it was a purse. But it went around your waist.
So it's a fanny pack?
Like a fanny pack, yeah.
It's a wallet chain fanny pack.
Yeah.
Why do we not still have those? Why do we not still? I would wear that every time I left the house. Are you kidding me?
Not especially adjustable, though, if you think about it.
I don't want it to be adjustable because I don't want thieves to adjust it off my body.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure there's a market out there for it if you want to go on Shark Tank.
Fuck yeah. I would love to go on Shark Tank. I would love to meet Mark Cuban. Give him a piece of my mind.
That would be great for you to go on Shark Tank and just have Justin and Sydney stumble upon you and we'd never tell them that it happened.
Yeah.
You're just watching and suddenly you're on there with your...
That would be great.
Your chained fanny pack.
I think they only like that weird Canadian Shark Tank, though. I don't think they watch...
Dragon's Den?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what really made the difference for pockets for women... was 1890s. There was an organization called the Rational Dress Society.
Fuck yes.
That called for women to dress for health, ditching corsets and wearing loose trousers and adopting clothing that allowed for movement, like bicycling.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's such a... What's the name of the organization again?
Rational Dress Society.
That's awesome.
And then this is right, this is right around when women are going into the workforce.
Right.
So all of a sudden they're able to wear pants and do all these things because they're desperately needed to have these very important jobs.
Right.
And a 1910, quote, suffragette suit with no less than 6 pockets became all the rage.
Awesome.
So this was a big time. There's a whole book about this called The Pocket, A Hidden History of Women's Lives from 1616 to 1900. Just talking about this evolution of pockets for women.
That is very fascinating.
But, you know, as fashion changes, you know, there are setbacks. I mean, I was reading an article. So a lot of what I pulled is from a Vox article in 2016. But there's just a lot of articles talking about how, like, essentially the front pockets for women are never functional. Like, they're always just, like, decorative. And a lot of that is for, like, as I mentioned earlier, like, this silhouette. You know, there's a lot of movements where, like, oh, we have pockets now. Nope, now we don't. Now it's not fashionable anymore. Just to kind of, you know, slim the front and the hips. You know, a lot of times they're removed. In 1954, Christian Dior famously said, "Men have pockets to keep things in, women for decoration."
All right.
But yeah, it's just like in 1933, you know, Women's Wear Daily is still saying, "Should women wear trousers?" Like, this has been a conversation for a very long time and continues to be. And, you know, speaking of silhouette, it made me think of the cargo short.
Oh, sure.
How it is, like, you know, reviled now because I think a lot of times it was a more baggy appearance.
Yeah. No, we're definitely, we're cresting the wave right now where we're going to soon just hate pockets again.
I know.
Yeah. For everyone.
I know, but I love the pocket.
I guess it's sort of, I'm more of a minimalist than you. Like, I don't need my wallet most of the time, you know?
Uh-huh. But you have a smaller phone now. You don't have a giant phone.
I have a tiny little phone. I could hold this thing in my mouth and just walk around. My mouth is a pocket for my teeth, if you think about it, and tongue.
What is happening to you today?
What is happening to you today? I would argue, madam. Can I do my second thing?
Yes.
My second thing is, I promise it's unironic. I don't know that I will be able to sell that. I don't bring ironic things to this show. I feel like that would be contrary to the spirit of the wonderful brand for us to bring things that we don't actually enjoy. So when I say that I love the song "What a Fool Believes" by the Doobie Brothers, I need people to understand that that is... that maybe that started out as an ironic enjoyment. I mean, here is my history with the Doobie Brothers and really all sort of music from the yacht rock era, which is that my dad fucking loved it.
This is what I'm wondering. I'm wondering how many more years I get with you before you become Clint McElroy.
I'm there, babe. I'm so sorry. at least from a, like, the kind of media I consume I've been there. But my dad would, like, play this music and I'd be like, this sucks, when I was younger. And then Yacht Rock, the web series came out, and then it was kind of like fun to make fun of it. And then I did enjoy it, like, ironically. Like, I would put it on the jukebox whenever we went to bars or whatever. And I think there's just been a very pleasant backslide into unironically enjoying the works of the Doobie Brothers, specifically "What a Fool Believes." And I think this song absolutely slaps. And if you laughed when I brought it up or dismissed it out of hand, I want you to just sort of cruise on the vibes right now as I play a little bit of the song "What a Fool Believes" by the Doobie Brothers. Did you listen to it when I told you I was going to bring it? You know the song, right?
I do know the song. I didn't seek it out, no, because I feel like I'm familiar with it.
I mean, the thing for me about this song, there's a lot, and I'm going to come back to this, but that synth sound that they have in it is the most pleasant, that, like, almost, like, calliope fucking circus whistle ass synth sound that's like, that was a really good impression of it. It's throughout the whole song. It's like my favorite little, it's like my favorite little instrument in all of recorded music. It's throughout the whole song. It's so pleasant, and they use every, like, inch of it. It's constantly, like, in the background, just sort of, like, accentuating the melody. And then at one point, it's just, like, very, very little, tiny little stabs of chords as they get into the pre-chorus that you can just barely hear in the background. But if you know to listen for that delightful, that delightful little synth, it's always right there. I'm a sucker for, I think this song, when did this song come out? Like, 79, I think. It came out on the Doobie Brothers 79 album, Minute by Minute. I like love old synths like that. Like, yeah. It's why I love Mort Garson as much as I do. And to hear one that is this prevalent in a song that went number one on the charts is like, is so fucking delightful to me. I also just like the structure of the song is so bizarre. I had never really read the lyrics to What a Fool Believes.
Yeah, I have not.
I'm just going to read it. I'm going to read some of like the beginning lyrics of What a Fool Believes, because when you hear it not in the context of the song, you're like, wait a minute, that's lyrics to a song? I'm just going to start. Okay. He came from somewhere back in her long ago, the sentimental fool, don't see trying hard to recreate what had yet to be created once in her life. She musters a smile for his nostalgic tale, never coming near what he wanted to say, only to realize it never really was. She had a place in his life. He never had to think twice. The only kind of rhyming couplet in the song. There. And he rises to her apology. Anybody else would surely know he's watching her go. But what a fool believes, he sees no wise man has the power to reason away. What seems to be is always better than nothing, and nothing at all keeps sending it. Like, what are you doing?
It feels like Shakespearean.
It's so wild. Like, it was written by Michael McDonald and Kenny Loggins.
Yeah.
And it just goes. It just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and goes like that.
You can't really attach to a particular image or narrative in that.
Right. It's just like one long train of thought.
Yeah.
So from like a songwriting perspective, that's wild.
Uh-huh.
That's like, I think you kind of have to give them a little bit more credit than you usually would when you hear, here's a song by the Doobie Brothers. Yeah, it's just absolutely, it's absolutely wild. It won, Minute by Minute won Record of the Year in 1980 Grammys, and What a Fool Believes won Song of the Year at the 1980 Grammys.
Wow.
And I think it's well-earned, man. I think it's, I think it's just a pleasant song that I like to vibe to, for sure. But I also think, like, by a lot of different ways that you could judge, a song lyrically, melodically.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned the harmonies.
Compositionally. I mean, the harmonies are absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good fucking song. It's my favorite Doobie Brothers song, and that's saying something. Because they got some slappers. They got some slappers in there. China Grove, forget about it. Taking it to the streets, stop it.
Oh, that is a good one.
Not as good as What a Fool Believes. Okay, so let's talk about what our friends at home are into. Finn says, I am a sewist, and something I find oh so wonderful is that sometimes I get to work with really soft fabric like Sherpa, which means spending the whole dang day half wrapped in the fluffiest material you ever did touch. I also find it wonderful that sewist is the term for people who sew. It's just very fun to say. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Fun fact from Finn. Thanks, Finn. Derek says, rarely does a garnish punch as far above its weight class as the maraschino cherry. It completes an ice cream sundae, becomes a boozy sweet treat in an old fashioned, and they're even good enough to eat right from the jar. I love a maraschino cherry. Huh. Oh my God. Yes. I think that's my favorite part of old fashions, which I enjoy an old fashioned every now and then, is when you do get to like the little fruit snack at the bottom.
Huh.
You don't like that? You don't like it?
So sweet. So
yes,
sweet.
Yes, that's a feature, not a bug.
I do like them in a milkshake because like I know what I'm getting into, right? Like that is sweet on sweet and I'm ready for it.
Yeah.
But when they're like in an alcoholic beverage, I'm like, whoa, what's this doing here?
You don't like a little chunky sip. That's not true. You like a Bloody Mary. It's not the texture that's upsetting you, though. It's the sweet.
Yeah. Huh.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. I think it's maybe...
it's like a little gusher in there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I worked at TCBY where we just had an infinite supply of maraschino cherries. So I'd just be in the back room just running them down. If my blood sugar was getting low, I would eat some maraschino cherries and I'd be like, what? It's vitamins.
I wish I had some footage, some security camera footage of you at that TCBY. I mean, I know that you found a spot where you could be undetected.
Yeah, or I could just play my Nintendo DS and eat maraschino cherries by myself in the corner behind the coats. Yep. Yep, yep, yep. Hey, thanks to Bone and Augustus for these for our theme song, Money Won't Pay. You can find a link to that in the episode description. And thank you to Maximum Fun for having us on the network. Go to MaximumFun.org. Check out all the great shows that are on MaximumFun.org.
Yeah, you should check out Reading Glasses.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like, you know, Poetry Corner for me is just like a little segment that I do every once in a while. But if you want to hear more about books, every episode.
Yeah, we had I want to recommend Fanti. We had an episode on our feed here last year, and that show is fucking great. It's funny.
Yeah, getting lots of recognition for how good that show is.
Yeah, absolutely. Catch the wave. Catch the Fanti wave. Yeah, I think that's probably going to do it. I mean, I can't think of other announcements. Oh, the podcast book comes out next week. Everybody Has a Podcast Except You. It's a book that me and my brothers wrote that Rachel got what would you call it? Like a guest diverse on.
Yeah, there is a chapter focused on research and just the experience of researching for a podcast. And me and Sydney and Teresa all wrote a little segment in there. It's I would recommend, okay, if you're like, well, I'm not going to do a podcast, so I don't need it. It's not a super technical book. It's very accessible. I would think if you enjoy the Macworld podcast and you want to know what the special sauce is,
sure,
that's the book for you.
We wrote it from a sort of hobbyist, a hobbyist reader, not for somebody who's like a, you know, going to start working for WNYC or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, it's we worked hard on it, and I'm proud of it. And it comes out next week, and you can find out more, like how to pre-order it or whatever, at McElroy.family. It would be super cool if you pre-ordered it. There is something of a freezing effect that our current sort of life situation has on book sales. So anything you can do to help us rectify that would be pretty cool. But that's it. Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks a million. Spank you.
Nope.
Very much.
Nope.
Spank you very much.
No. No, thank you.
Spanks for the memories. Do you like this guy?
No, not at all.
You don't? What do you not like about him?
Ooh, there's a lot. There's a lot.
Okay. Just to say it. He's a big boy. He can take it. Say what you need to say about the Spanker, and then let's move on.
He's not remotely funny or charming or attractive to me. You said he could take it.
Oh, he could. I can't.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.